This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. The war in Gaza has reached a grim milestone, 1 year. It's been a year since the shocking and deadly Hamas-led attack in Israel. 1 year of bombardments in Gaza that targeted everything from military strongholds to hospitals full of civilians. In the U.S., it's been a year of mourning and empathy, but also a year of campus protests, fiery debates on Capitol Hill, and that too familiar feeling of overwhelm that leads us to turn off the TV, fold up the newspaper, put down the phone, and turn away. Today, we hope you will help us mark this anniversary. How has the war in Gaza and the region impacted you in the past year? Call in this hour at 800-639-2211 or send us an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Here is a condensed timeline of the events of the past year.
Dramatic developments happening in Israel. The militant group Hamas firing thousands of rockets into the country.
Israel has declared war after Hamas militants launched a surprise coordinated attack.
The Israeli military launching additional airstrikes in the densely populated southern city of Rafah.
A terrifying wave of Israeli settler violence has engulfed the West Bank.
Israel's military says Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah was killed in a strike in Beirut, Lebanon.
Tonight, Iran has launched a barrage of missiles towards Israel on the same day that Israel launched a ground invasion into southern Lebanon against Hezbollah.
Our guest this hour knows the pain of war intimately. Tarek El Aris is the James Wright Professor and Chair of Middle Eastern Studies, at Dartmouth College. His memoir of growing up during the Lebanese Civil War came out earlier this year. It's called Water on Fire, A Memoir of War. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Tarek, a wider role between between Israel and Hamas and their allies in the region is unfolding as we speak. Israel recently invaded Lebanon, for one, your home country. What did it feel like to hear the news of those attacks?
I feel like it's replaying my memories as a child when I was growing up in 1982, when actually Israel invaded Lebanon with the intent of kicking out the Palestine Liberation Organization and Yasser Arafat, who were kind of leading the charge against for resistance and, you know, cross-border attacks and so on. And so today we have different actors, but the same process, the same invasion, bombardment, the displacement of people, horrible violence. And I feel like this cycle of war that I grew up with keeps repeating. It's almost like there is no end in sight. It feels like a reel that keeps playing, replaying, and it fills me with great anxiety, despair, and feelings of terrible sadness that somehow we're not able to break the cycle.
Mm. And Tarek, in your book, you discuss the horrors of the war in Lebanon, but also the beauty of Beirut and the things that you loved about growing up there, even though it was the midst of the Lebanese Civil War. I'm wondering if you might be able to share with us maybe a strong memory from childhood, a place or a food or a smell that still brings you right back to home today.
One thing we did growing up is go to the beach. Mm. I mean, Beirut is a peninsula, and we were cut off from the inland. We couldn't, a lot of times, you know, Beirut was divided into East and West Beirut, and this was part of the Civil War, which started in 1975 and continued. So our only outlet was going to the beach, and it wasn't a fancy beach. It was just poured with concrete, and it was a rocky beach. But we went in the summer, especially when the weather was nice, we went every day, and we just fished and snorkeled and just tanned and played and swam and jumped in the water. And this is the theme of my book. That's why it's called Water on Fire, to talk about being close to water, but turning to water as well as an escape from the fire, from the war that was surrounding us. And this is something I'm always drawn to. This is something that brings me peace today. Whenever I see a lake or a beach or I'm close to water, this is something I always need to have close by. It's almost my safety. And of course, this is a way to resist this ongoing closure, this ongoing conflict, to say we insist on doing something to reinvent our humanity, which was being assailed every day through bombs, violence, abduction, all kinds of horrors that we had to deal with. And so swimming, fishing, these were the things that allowed us to survive and allowed me to survive. And I discussed this throughout the book, how we invented little tricks to continue to live, to continue to invent a reality that is adjacent to the reality of war that was trying to crush us.
Mm, so living in two worlds at the same time as best you can. Well, yeah. Tarek, you've been generous enough to join us today to help us mark this 1 year anniversary. But of course, as you've brought up, in many ways, it is a cycle. This dates back decades, if not centuries, of conflict in this region that has really become a global conflict at this point. Let's bring in some calls. And if you have thoughts this hour too, you can also email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org if that feels better to you. Let's start with Wafiq in Richmond. Wafiq, I believe you're the same Wafiq with Vermonters for Justice in Palestine. Is that right?
Yes, I am a member
of Vermont for Justice in Palestine, and I live in Richmond, and I've been living in Vermont for 30 years. I'm calling, number one, to correct your station and many mainstream media that this war is not against Hamas in Gaza and West Bank and against Hezbollah in Lebanon. I born and grow up refugee in Lebanon, and I experienced the war like our guests on this program. And I believe you have to understand, you have to talk about Israeli occupation, Israeli apartheid, and the mistreatment of Palestinians. You may talk about the Israeli hostages and commemorating the attack on October 7. October 7 came in after 75 years of October against the Palestinians. You're going to talk about what you call Israeli hostages, and you didn't bring 14 to 16,000 Palestinian political prisoners. Many of them are children, many of them are women, and they don't bring them to any court to release them. Mm. The Palestinian resistance or Lebanese resistance, they had no choice because it's under international law and Geneva Convention. There is a right of the people under direct occupation to defend themselves.
Wafiq, I'm sorry. I just want to jump in here because I think you're bringing up a lot of really important history. And we're also lucky enough to be joined by the chair of the Middle Eastern Studies at Dartmouth College today, our guest, Tarek El Aris. Tarek, can you talk to us about how you have been incorporating this longstanding history into the present day discussions that you're having with your students who might only be aware of the more recent history, unlike what Wafiq is bringing up?
Yeah. I mean, at Dartmouth, we teach courses on the subject, on the contemporary conflict. And also I teach a course with my colleague, Susanna Heschel, chair of Jewish studies, called The Arab, the Jew, and the Construction of Modernity, which is on the 19th century, which is the how basically Arabs and Jews started thinking of themselves as modern subjects. And also Proto-Zionism comes out of this, and all kinds of political projects come out of these this time period. That so we take the students to the past also to give them an idea of how this conflict, first of all, it's a modern conflict. It's very important that we mention that. I don't think it's centuries old. I think it's decades old for sure. And it's and to expose students to the history of how you know, Jews in Europe, but also Jews in the Middle East, in Egypt, in Lebanon, or which was back then under the Ottoman Empire, how they lived. Some of them wrote in Arabic. I mean, they wrote, you know, they identified with that part of the world. Some of them, you know, start to modernize the language. Hebrew starts becoming modernized at the end of the 19th century. So we expose students to different narratives that sometimes involve forms of coexistence as well that was happening in that part of the world in the 19th and even into the early 20th century. And then we also offer courses, my colleagues offer courses on the contemporary conflicts and the current situation. So we try to do what we can to give the students the tools to understand that history. So when things happen today, they understand the context. They know how to situate them, and they are not just simply reacting to current events without any understanding of the larger context.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, and I'm sorry to cut you off there. I want to make sure we bring in as many voices as possible from our communities this hour. I want to share an email we got from Susan, who writes, "There is no denying that the attack on Israel by Hamas was inhuman and egregious, and what has ensued has been equally egregious. The annihilation of Gaza is absolutely abhorrent. As a global culture, we should be beyond settling conflict with the death of tens of thousands of innocent civilians, the complete devastation and destruction of infrastructure, and the torture of human beings." Tarek, you've said that you've taught about this history in the classroom. You have also lived a part of this history growing up in Lebanon during the Civil War. What is it like? What does it feel like to share those stories from your own childhood with students? I can imagine it's a really helpful way for them to understand the impact of war, but I can also imagine it would be very difficult to share those personal stories on a stage such as a college classroom.
Yeah, that's why I decided to write this book, because I felt like war is a horrible, traumatizing experience, destructive. But I also wanted to talk about, what does it mean to survive a war like this? What does it mean that, what are the traces of violence that sometimes we don't see? It is not just simply physical traces like a missing limb or an eye or obviously death as we are seeing today on the news, but what are the invisible traces of war and violence on people? How do they scar us so deeply, and how do we live with these scars? And this is what I'm trying to look at, the human experience of war that we don't see, we don't observe, and we really need to dig and understand how they shape us. And this is what the book is about. But also, how do we deal with them? How do we live with them? So it is a book on going through this horrible experience, but also coming up with models of survival, and how do we survive these things? Because the kids, and I mean, I was a child when this was going on. So and I know that the kids that are being subjected to this right now, they are gonna go through similar. Those who will survive, you know, those who will not die under the bombs, those who will survive, they are going to have to deal with these scars as well. And I wanted to show this to the students as well, like how, what does it mean to carry these wounds and to have them with you all the time, and how they shape your imagination, how they shape your relation to people, how they shape the kind of work you do, so it is something that is all encompassing, and it's not just simply something we can isolate and deal with and treat, but it is a larger experience that we have to deal with. And if we don't understand this, we don't understand the effects of this violence, we can't start thinking of ways to interrupt the cycle of violence and think of ways to empower people who might offer us a way out, because what we're seeing is a repetition, and this is the tragedy.
Let's pause here and take a break for a moment. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, we'll take your calls, and we'll be joined by a University of Vermont professor. You can call in at 800-639-2211. More in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Today, we are marking the one-year anniversary of October 7th, the deadliest single day in Israel's history, and the resulting escalation of war in which tens of thousands of Palestinians have been killed. Our guest is Tarek El-Aris, Dartmouth College's Chair of Middle Eastern Studies. His memoir of growing up during the Lebanese Civil War came out this year. I'd also like to add one more voice to the conversation here. Peter Henny is an associate political science professor at the University of Vermont and the director of UVM's Middle East Studies program. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Now, the last time we spoke, Peter, was in August. It was before the start of the new school year. And last year, of course, has left many college students in Vermont, New Hampshire, and across the country feeling angry and uncertain. This is following the massive protest movement that we saw unfold on campuses all across the United States. Does it feel like things are, quote unquote, back to normal at UVM and in your classrooms specifically?
I think there still is a lot of frustration and a lot of concern about what's going on. Things do feel less heated than in the spring. And I'm getting a sense of student interest in working this out. So I taught a lecture on international law last week, and a lot of the conversation was the details of the international criminal courts, arrest warrants for Prime Minister Netanyahu and leadership of Hamas. It was really detailed things about how could international law deal with this. I had a lecture on Israel-Palestine last week in my Middle East politics course, and we did focus on, you know, why is this expanding? What are the incentives for Israeli and Hamas leadership to keep this war going? What is Iran up to? And it's I'm sorry that they're having to deal with these questions, but it's also encouraging that they're trying to work through this constructively. Hmm.
Tarek, what do you think? I mean, last May, police arrested nearly 90 people at a pro-Palestinian protest, and there was a lot of controversy over the police response and the administration's response. What is the tenor of things on campus today?
I mean, they're processing. I think I agree with Peter that there is processing, there is reflection, but of course the frustration is there. I mean, the war, not only is it not ending, but it is expanding to other parts of the region. Now it's in Lebanon and it might expand further. So, you know, there is, you know, we've entered into something that's become less likely, I mean, very unclear where it is going. And we have started the dialogue project right after the October 7th attack. I mean, we've already had these courses on Israel-Palestine, on history, and all of that already in place. But we've been inviting a lot of people to campus to come and talk to the students and inform them, but also allow them to express themselves and their concerns about what's going on. And we're meeting with the students, we're, you know, mediating, we've had a very supportive administration who's been also supporting us and efforts to create dialogue and bring people together to talk and discuss and process what's going on. Yeah. I feel like it is a long-term situation that we need to acknowledge and be ready for.
Let's go back to the phone lines. We have Ashley calling in from Burlington. Ashley, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, my name's Ashley Smith from the Vermont Coalition for Palestinian Liberation. I'm pleased that people are talking about the historical context of what's going on in the Middle East right now, because in reality, this war, which is really a genocide, did not start on October 7th, nor did it end on October 7th. And it's really the result of what Rashid Khalidi calls the 100-year history of the war on Palestine, which the Zionist settler colonial state has conquered sections of Palestinian land, attempted to expand it, imposed apartheid in the areas that it does control. And that has produced resistance, understandably, by oppressed people. And they have every right to resist in whatever way they see fit. And Israel has taken October 7th as an opportunity to carry out genocide in Gaza, expanding it into the West Bank, now into Lebanon, and now confronting Iran, threatening the whole region with war. And none of this could have been done without the military and financial backing of the United States, which uses Israel as its local cop in the region to police control of the oil reserves in the region. And so,
Ashley, I just want to jump in here because what you're saying echoes a lot of the messages that we've been getting via email as well. We just got an email from Duncan in Thetford, for example, who writes, "The war has affected all of our lives by staining our reputation as a country of values. The war by Israel against civilians in Gaza and the West Bank and the cruelty of our policy of supplying 70% of Israel's weapons to Israel. What country will want to partner with us after this?" There is a call at the federal level right now, led in part by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, to block the sale of additional weaponry to Israel. Peter, are you keeping a close eye on this? Do you think that this is something that we might see in the near term, this blockage of sale of weaponry?
Probably not. I think there is a lot of desire to continue our military alliance with Israel. I think there's also a fair case to be made that, you know what, we cut off funding and arms to Israel, we lose any leverage we already have. And so I understand the frustration that the United States has not stopped this war. But, you know, Secretary of State Blinken has been shuttling back and forth. Biden has been pressing Netanyahu. They're probably not as effective as they could be, but I think there is this desire on the U.S. side to get to a ceasefire. And I think the trick for people who want to see a real peace emerge in a way that benefits Palestinians and Israelis is to figure out how can we get to that point, which does require careful negotiation, which can be frustrating.
Hmm. Well, thank you, Ashley, for calling in. Let's go next to Katie in Winooski. Katie, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I am calling in. I wanted to share that the reason we're in Vermont in the first place is actually because my husband publicly resigned from the United States Air Force after 12 years of service because of his horror over how the Biden administration has handled this. And Michaela, at the beginning, what prompted me is you said this can be really overwhelming to witness, and I think it's easy to turn away. And as a new Vermonter, I really wanted to connect with other people who are following this and want to do something about it. And I wanted to invite other people in Vermont to join me. There's actually a conference happening in Burlington on October 19th. It's a free conference to learn more about what's going on and what you as a Vermonter can do. So Google that conference on October 19th. And I just wanted to share one example of how this is emotional for me, but it's easy to get caught up in the history and the politics and the laws. And I think those are really, really important. But one example of why my husband resigned is because I think it's easy to use the fact that it's complicated as an excuse to confuse you of what's going on. And I'm thinking of Mohammed Bahar, who was a autistic man in Palestine, in Gaza, who the Israeli military allowed dogs to maul to near death and then left him to die alone. And I think that should be horrifying to anybody, but my son is autistic and nonverbal like Mohammed is. And I do not want to live in a world where that is ever justified, where someone tells me that it's complicated and maybe there is a justification for that. I don't think that allowing that to happen to someone is complicated. I think it's either right or wrong. I don't think that burying children alive under rubble is complicated. I think it's either right or wrong. I don't think targeting journalists is complicated. It's either right or wrong. So just wanted to point out that don't lose touch with their humanity. I think it's clear to see what's going on here. And I would love to see anyone else who feels that way at the conference on October 19th.
Katie, thank you so much for calling in and sharing those words. I can hear in your voice how deeply this touches you and your family. Tarek, as someone who also has experienced this war on a very personal level, I wonder if you might have any words for Katie and others who are grappling with what they're seeing in the news and thinking about, you know, this could be my own family.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this is really horrible. I mean, I have no words to describe what's going on. I think it is horrible and people are feeling it in a deep, deep way. And this is something, you know, I completely understand. I have students who come to my office and talk, and I just listen to them and listen deeply, listen and try to kind of take in also what they're saying, what they're feeling. So as a professor, I feel like on the one hand, I need to go to my class and give that history lesson and explain things and inform and instruct, but I also have to listen and recognize that what we, the horror that we are witnessing and that they are seeing, you know, with new media, with the availability of images and videos in unprecedented ways. So this is a reality that we need to understand and recognize and empathize with, as well as try to do our job and instruct and explain and offer them a context so that they make informed decisions that will empower them going forward.
Speaking of new media, we also put out a call on Instagram earlier this morning for comments for people who feel most comfortable speaking there. We got a couple folks writing in on Instagram. Here are a few lines of what they said. One wrote, "The war has profoundly affected me. The silence in Vermont is deafening." Another writes, "The war has opened my eyes to acknowledge that this is an occupation." And a third person writes, "The war has made me acknowledge that every person living is kin, and that I care for them to be safe." I also want to read an email now that we got from Christopher, who is a teacher at Hanover High School. And Christopher writes, "As a social studies teacher, I have had to walk the finest line between my own activism for Palestinian liberation outside the classroom and trying to explain the news and history in as unbiased a manner as possible inside the classroom. As an Iranian American, I have been torn apart by the brutality and barbarism of the Israeli military campaign. Many students at my high school have gone from ignorance to a burning quest for justice. The past year has taught me the power of activism and community and how quickly the communities we live and work in can become fractured, polarizing, and hostile." Now, both of our guests today have done a lot of work in the past year and prior to foster dialogue that is not polarizing and hostile. Peter, I'd love to ask this question of both of you. Is there a moment that you think of in either this past couple weeks of this school year or the one prior that gave you a little bit of hope that maybe a class that you're teaching or a group that you were part of was kind of creating some sort of understanding or bond around this war that hadn't existed prior?
Yeah, I think so. So last fall, I have a session in my Middle East class on the Israel-Palestine peace process, and many recommended I drop that session. But I thought, you know, I'll go ahead, and I've got tenure, so hopefully that helps a little bit if things get out of control. And the students were tense, but like they were sitting and listening. And one student kind of made a sort of angry statement, which they're allowed to do, but everyone just sort of was calm. And actually at one point they said, "I feel like we're being a little more quiet than we usually are because we're grappling with how to even respond to this." And I think that's a positive thing. And I tell them, you know, it's okay to have strong emotions. It's okay to be an activist. But my job here in the classroom is to teach you and give you the tools to then engage with this. And I think they were realizing that, which was encouraging.
And Tarek, I mean, at Dartmouth, you co-teach a course with the chair of the Jewish Studies Department. You've also visited college campuses all across the country to share the lessons that you've learned about creating these productive classroom environments. Is there a particular moment that you could point to as an example of that type of pedagogy really, I guess, working in your eyes?
Yeah, I mean, you know, even when there was a protest at Dartmouth, I mean, it was happening outside of our classroom, and the students were supporting each other, even those who disagreed politically. They were there for each other, and they were they cared for each other, and they were learning in the classroom, and these are the tools that we provide them with. And then what they do with these tools, we respect and support them what they do with these tools. And we want to ensure, and we have ensured, the end of the class, we had students from different backgrounds. And they were all, like, they felt they were heard. They felt united. They felt connected to one another. And this is important for us. This is a community that we want to preserve, that we want to uphold. And this is a community that, you know, needs to be a community of care fundamentally. And what they do in the world, this is where, you know, the tools we give them, how we empower them, and they all came together at the end beautifully, despite the political disagreements. And I think that is very important, and we need to strive for that.
Let's take another phone call here. We have Mish calling in from Plainfield. Mish, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, folks. I'm an observant Jew, and my parents taught me about the Holocaust. What we are seeing in Palestine now is a Holocaust, and it is completely unacceptable under my and many other Jews' moral standards. The occupation of the West Bank of the Jordan is absolutely unacceptable. It's against international law. There are people who are losing their homes. There are illegal settlements under international law that are being established under the right-wing government that currently controls Israel. Look, we have relatives in Israel. We're worried about them. Unless there is the establishment of a free Palestinian state, there will be no end to war.
Mish, so thank you so much for calling in. I'm just jumping in here because I want to make sure we give some other folks a moment to share their thoughts. I really appreciate you calling in. Jordan in Milton is also on the line. Jordan, go ahead.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Jordan, first generation Bosnian diaspora, born and raised in Vermont. I'm also a member of the Vermont Coalition for Palestinian Liberation. I'm going to quickly touch on the Bosnian experience and how it relates to Palestine. I'm one out of many within the Bosnian community who have family who lived through four long years of Nazi occupation. We know war, we know siege, we know genocide, and also from our most recent experience during the violent breakup of Yugoslavia. And during the Second World War, we went to great lengths to protect our Jewish brothers and sisters, such as the example of my great-grandmother hiding a few Jewish neighbors and their families in their homes.
Go ahead. Finish your thought there.
And we must engage in similar activities advocating for the end of the ongoing genocide in Palestine.
Thank you, Jordan, for jumping in and sharing that history and that connection that you're feeling as somebody with roots in Bosnia, which also experienced a genocide there. I have to jump in because we're going to take one more short break here. When we come back, we will continue our conversation, our reflection, and take more of your calls. You can also email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Today, we are marking the one-year anniversary of the October 7th attacks and the ongoing war in Gaza and the surrounding region. Our guests are UVM Professor Peter Henney, the director of UVM's Middle East Studies program, and Tarek El Aris, Dartmouth College's chair of Middle Eastern Studies. Tarek, I read a quote in your book, your memoir, which came out earlier this year, excuse me, if my memory serves, it might have been from an interview that you did. And you said, I have it written here, we have to be pedagogically creative, especially to deal with a situation that is so difficult emotionally. I'm just fascinated by both of your experience in the classroom, as I keep returning to in this conversation, and the types of creative pedagogical leaps that you've had to try out in the past year to deal with these incredibly difficult conversations that you're having. I think, maybe I'm feeling that myself as we try to foster dialogue on this show. I'm wondering if you could maybe share another moment from the classroom of something that you tried out this year that you hadn't before as a way to meet this present moment in a classroom format. Tarek.
Yeah, I mean, the classroom is one part of this pedagogical engagement. I mean, there is also the students come to my office. As I was saying, they share, they listen. Sometimes I communicate, discreetly some of the things that are troubling the students. And so we have to coordinate and collaborate. And being at the university, we need to work together. Professors, teachers, advisors, administration, it is very important that there is a coordination, especially in moments like this, when also the mental health of the students are at stake. These are not things that students have opinions about, but they are deeply moved by. And we need to acknowledge that and make sure that they are in a space where they're able to read and look at the history, which is part of what they have to do at the university and take the courses, but at the same time, make sure that their mental health, their emotional state is also being acknowledged. And that has to be communicated. And we need to find that the space for that. And this is the kind of creative pedagogy that is in the classroom, that is in the office, that involves different parties that are collaborating and coordinating to make sure that we get through this. Mm. And this year, I mean, I taught actually a class on the Middle East on 9/11 in New York City. I mean, so wow. I have to tell you, I was supposed to meet with my students that Tuesday at NYU to teach a documentary called Islam, Empire of Faith. And needless to say, we didn't meet. I came back a week later and I had to deal with a very difficult situation, with people having lost. I mean, I also almost lost my partner in the 9/11 attacks. So I had to be creative and understand that these moments of crisis requires a different connection as well. And I can't just simply stay at the, here, read this about Islam or about the politics and about what's going on. No, I have to be present emotionally as well.
Right.
And this is the way we get through this and recognize the pain of the people who are in front of me.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Tarek. Peter, you have written in the past about the role of grassroots peace efforts. Do you see hope for any of those types of efforts having an actual effect on a conflict as large as what we're seeing in Gaza and the surrounding region?
Yeah, I do. If only because that's the only way forward, I think. We're not going to have another Camp David meeting or an Oslo process until the people on the ground force the two sides to work together. And we are seeing examples of this. There are women's groups in Israel, Israeli Palestinians that get together and work on this. There's interfaith dialogue going on in cities like Haifa. It's easy to dismiss this. A good mentor said, the only people who show up to those are the ones who already agree to be peaceful anyways, which is often true, but it creates these conditions of possibility for broader talks. And I, and something I encourage my students in class, think, well, what's the purpose of this conversation? And I'd also encourage you know, people in the community, you know, with heated opinions think about what are you trying to get out of your activism on this issue? Is it vengeance, which I understand the need to push that for some people, but or is it peace? And I think there are a lot of people in the region who want peace, and the trick is helping them find the space to work on that and support them in what they're actually looking for. So yes, I do see some hope.
Thank you for that. I want to share a couple more emails here. One listener writes that their husband's family are Palestinian citizens of Israel. Our family, they write, also has many relatives who live in the West Bank, which has been under siege for most of the past year. It's been a terrible year for our family in so many ways, starting, of course, with the indiscriminate and horrific attacks of 10/7 and the subsequent killing, maiming, and displacement of tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians in Gaza, the West Bank, and now Palestinian and Lebanese civilians in Lebanon. Another person, Ray, actually, in Jamaica, writes, Jews have been in Israel for over 3,000 years. That's historical fact. When terrorists come and brutally murder and rape and kidnap citizens in their own home, how should the government react? Should they celebrate the terrorists, those who wish such violence, and celebrate it endlessly, or hunt them down? So just an example of the many divergent opinions that we are hearing in our own community about this conflict. Let's take Rachel next. Rachel, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I'm calling from Israel, and I have not been able to listen to the whole show. I was actually running to a bomb shelter earlier today due to missiles launched by Hamas. But what I was calling to say is that October 7th is the anniversary of the deadliest attack on Jews since the Holocaust. And it is a day that should be reserved for the mourning and the community grieving and also community support of the Jewish people. There is nothing controversial about that. And to equivocate what happened since October 7th with October 7th itself, which was the start of this conflict. October 7th is when my student, Roni Polvanov, was murdered at the Nova Music Festival, when the kibbutzim that I walked were ravaged of their people and they are still held hostage in Gaza. October 7th, that was the only thing that happened that day. So I believe that it is dismissive and dehumanizing to the Jewish people to use October 7th as a day of collective mourning for the entire war, a war which was started with the terror attack on October 7th that must be seen as something that will be coming for us in America if we are not wise enough to stand up against the unbridled genocidal hate of those who broke down the border fences that I have seen and entered the sovereign nation of Israel with the sole intent of killing as many Jews as possible. There are still 7 Americans held hostage in Gaza. That needs to be our focus today.
Rachel, I'm going to jump in here. I am so sorry to hear about the death of your student and what you have experienced there in Israel, and I really appreciate you calling in. Now, what I'm hearing in your call is this desire to have October 7th, this day, be specifically a day of remembrance for the killing of so many people in Israel during those Hamas-led attacks. And yet it has become something more, whether one agrees with that or not. And I'd love to hear both of our guests' thought on this. On this date, October 7th, and the symbolism that it is now like unable to shed in some ways, just like 9/11 is that number that we will never forget here in the United States. Tarek, let's start with you.
I mean, what happened on October 7th was a horrible, horrible crime, and it's really needs to be condemned with no uncertain, you know, with no wavering or equivocation whatsoever. And of course, we think of the context and history with professors. I teach that part of the world. So, but what happened on October 7th was horrible and needs to be condemned. And acknowledged as the crime, the horrible crime that it was. And that needs to be clear and without any equivocation. So, but I think, you know, what we as you said, October 7th is also linked to a process that we are now in. So it's kind of, we're also talking about October 7th and what comes afterwards. And it's, but it, I don't think it should be in any way to justify what happened on October 7th or minimize it. I think it is very important to acknowledge it and acknowledge the pain and the violence that people were subjected to and the murder that people were subjected to.
Mm. Thank you, Tarek. And Peter, any thoughts to add there?
Yeah, you know, I mostly agree. I think the world is complex, whether or not we want to allow it. And there is a context for everything, but that does not justify or excuse violence or indiscriminate killing of civilians by anyone. So I think it's possible to say on this day of October 7th, we remember the people of Israel who were killed and mourn that. And then also start thinking about, you know, the next day, the Palestinians have been killed. And then again, the bigger goal for me is how do we get out of this situation? And I don't see any of these as mutually exclusive, although I understand that they can be without if we're not careful.
So I guess we're left with these couple minutes left with this question, what comes next? And let's focus that as tightly as we can on our own communities here in this region and the classrooms that you two are a part of. How will you be marking this day and this period of the war in your own classrooms or college communities? Tarek?
You know, I'm not teaching this term, so fortunately, I'll be teaching my class in the spring, and this is something we're definitely going to engage with. And my colleagues now are engaging with this anniversary in their classrooms and reflecting and revisiting what they've done over the year and where they are, and also thinking of those pedagogical ways to move forward, to bring the community together, to mourn those who died and who are dying, who continue to be dying. And try to think of healing the community so and empowering the community so that we can you know, look into the future and move forward and take care of each other.
Mm. And Peter.
Yeah, I well, so in my class this morning I gave a little spiel similar to what I just gave about, you know, recognizing today and the horrors then, but not minimizing what the Palestinians have gone through. You know, last Friday when we talked about Israel-Palestine, I left time to talk. But the flip side is, you know, I'm teaching a course on Middle East politics today, right in like 2 minutes. And we're talking about Algeria. And I do feel a responsibility to not just focus on Israel-Palestine and give students a broader perspective. So I'm going to acknowledge it, but I don't want to change my entire curriculum to focus on this one horrific event.
Hmm. Well, Professor, let's get you to class. That's UVM Professor Peter Henney, the director of UVM's Middle East Studies program. Peter, thank you so much for your time today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And Tarek El Aris is Dartmouth College's Chair of Middle Eastern Studies, and you can also find his memoir on bookshelves near you. Tarek, thank you so much for your time and your thoughtfulness today.
Thank you, Michaela.
Today's show was directed by Liz Fullerton. Our managing producer is John Ahrens. Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro are our producers. Kelly Delorier was our call screener today, and our theme music is by Myra Flynn. If you have lingering thoughts on this conversation, as I know I will, feel free to email us at any time at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thanks so much for listening, and we will catch up again soon.